The following special presentation is brought to you by SEA Limited, forensic engineering and origin cause experts working nationwide since 1970. Hi, everybody. This is Dan Walker. Welcome to the June edition of U.S. Law Radio. This time around, we're going international. When we get big enough to expand beyond our borders, things get a little bit different, as you can well imagine. As our show unfolds, we'll take a look at some of the subtle and not-so-subtle differences in the law and how the Trans-European Law Firm Association, TELFA, is there to help. The news you need starts right here. Let's get rolling. On the move with the news you need, this is U.S. Law Radio. So what do you need to watch out for if you're a business on the verge of going global? There are a unique set of concerns inherent to international transactions that can make or break your business. Fred Leffler is a partner with Retzel & Andrus in Akron, and he joins us now with some really good points. Fred, welcome into U.S. Law Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
To kick things off, Fred, what are the biggest obstacles that companies here in the U.S. face when they begin doing business overseas?
Well, there really are a whole host of issues that they should consider when you do business internationally. You have lots of different layers of problems to consider than the multiple layers you already have when you are doing business domestically. The biggest ones, I think, are going to be dealing with the risks that you have with the shipping and payment risks, who's going to bear those and how you're going to allocate those, dealing with the host country laws and how they're going to affect the way that you do business overseas, because those are a whole myriad of issues. U.S. laws then that affect international transactions always have to be considered as well. Again, there are many additional risks. Business is about managing risk, and our job as lawyers is to help folks understand what they are and then deal with those either by good operations or by paying someone else to bear those risks.
Well, we're going to focus more tightly on some of the issues you just brought up, but first, are there any particular areas of the world that are of more interest to U.S. companies? For example, China, Middle East, India?
Well, certainly China and India are the hot places, hotbeds of activity right now because of the sheer volume of business that's going on over there and the opportunities that those markets are presenting, both as a sourcing products, a place to source products, or a new market to sell our products into. Obviously, we've seen the former for the last few years, and now the latter is starting to become more and more of an issue as people are doing business over there and selling over there.
Okay, well, let's drill down to some more specific questions here. First, how can we be sure that terms in domestic transactions will translate into the same terms used in an international scenario?
One of the situations or parts of the transaction that can trip people up unawares are the shipping terms. Most everybody's going to be familiar with the Uniform Commercial Code, or the UCC as it's referred to as a shorthand, and it has shipping terms, and it deals with who's going to bear the costs and the risks that are involved in transporting goods from the seller to the buyer. And there are terms like FOB, free alongside, those types of terms that are used. And when we go to an international transaction, sometimes you'll see those very same terms being used, but they mean something completely different. There's a set of shipping terms that is customarily used in international transactions called Incoterms, Incoterms, that's spelled out. Incoterms 2000, they were promulgated by the International Chamber of Commerce as a way to have uniform shipping terms. Everybody in the business knows what these things mean. As long as you get to the Incoterms listing and understand what is your shipping terms are going to be, you're going to understand what risks you're assuming and what risks you're not assuming. If you don't look at those definitions, you may be signing up for costs and risk that you didn't intend to because you're used to using the Uniform Commercial Code. So very, very important to make sure you understand what the Incoterms are that you're talking with your client and your customer and getting the right ones inserted into the agreements. Otherwise, you'll have some surprises.
We sure don't need those. Incoterms it is. Next question, obviously there will be some payment and shipment risks in international transactions. How do we deal with that?
The seller is concerned about, here I am shipping my goods, I want to make sure I get paid. And the buyer is over there saying, I'm going to give you a bunch of money, I want to make sure I get my goods. How do we deal with those? They use the documentary transfer system as a way to minimize those risks. What you're going to do is you're going to use letters of credits and bills of lading that will transfer the transaction from the sale of goods to the sale of papers, be that the bill of lading and then the transfer under the letters of credit. And what that allows you to do is you have people working for you in remote locations that are going to say, yes, Mr. Buyer, you are now getting the goods that you anticipated getting. It looks to me as if everything here is what you want. So you can authorize payment, and the buyer would then authorize the letter of credit to be paid upon, and instantaneously the seller can go get money wired into his account and not have to wait for a check to come from overseas from the seller, which obviously is going to take quite some time. It speeds up the transaction considerably. It reduces the risk of fraud, and it also makes these payment and non-delivery risks are much, much more easily managed, and maybe even say rare, as compared to what you would have if you I'm going to pay you COD or I'm going to pay you 30 days after delivery, those types of things. It's an easier way to make sure you're getting what you anticipate getting and doing it in a much faster situation.
On the topic of money, are there any particular currency risks that we should be aware of in dealing internationally?
Really, there are three. You have to make sure that when you receive funds from a host country, are you going to be able to get those funds out? Some less developed countries are not allowing you to take those funds out of the country. So you may have sold a product, made a nice profit. If you don't get to take the money home, it doesn't really do you any good. There also would be issues of, can you convert it into U.S. dollars? How do we do that? And talking to a local banker and a local attorney would be helpful in looking at that.
What kind of exchange rate risks are there inherent in international transactions?
Yeah, the third risk with currency has to do with the exchange rate. We have seen a lot of that in the news lately as the dollar is slid in value. When payments are being made, if I'm going to pay someone in Europe, I may pay them in U.S. dollars or I may pay them in euros. They may not want dollars. They may only want euros. They may see that the dollars are going to continue to slide. I don't want those things being wired to my account. So the parties have to agree upon who is going to bear that risk of whether the currency that they would normally pay in, is that going to go up or down? And if you want to minimize your risk, you're going to say, other side, you're going to have to deal with it. You can deal with that risk by buying futures or buying hedge funds to acquire the funds and lock in at an exchange rate now, thinking that it may get worse in the future. You can minimize your risk, but you're going to have to pay for that by doing that.
Great advice. So the laws of the host countries, certainly they are different, many, and varied. How do they affect international transactions, Fred?
When you're a visitor, you've got to make sure you play by the rules of the people you're visiting. Talking with a good, trusted local attorney there in that country is going to be invaluable. They're going to know where the pitfalls are. They're going to know what's going to work and what's not going to work. And the systems that we use here and the things that we assume here in the States, don't count on them necessarily being the case over there. Many of them will be, but there are going to be a lot of pitfalls. For example, if you name someone to be a distributor in a country, you may think, we're just giving him the rights to distribute the product here for us. Well, the laws of that country might say, nope, guess what? He is your only distributor in this country, and you cannot use anyone else to distribute your product in this country without violating his rights, and the government will back them up and make things very difficult for you. So you need to know what distribution rights you're granting intentionally or inadvertently. That is one big issue. Another one, what happens upon the termination of a relationship, be that as a distributor or an agent? Many countries require that the principal give a severance payment to the agent or the distributor that's being terminated. Even if it's being terminated for cause or the period of the agreement has expired, you may still owe the person in the host country funds upon the end of that relationship, and that could be a cost that you did not build into your pricing model and may suddenly make what was a profitable venture to be a costly one. A number of countries require that you register the contract with the host country government. If you want to be able to enforce it, if you want to be able to do anything with that agreement in that country, you have to advise them, maybe even get their approval as to the terms. That's the case in some developing countries. Make sure you understand what taxes the host country is going to impose upon you. Again, it may very significantly affect your pricing model and, again, turn what looks like a good opportunity into a very expensive one. Some countries will also impose obligations on you that you never included in the contract, that suddenly are going to be bearing down upon you, and you're going to have to deal with them. The only way to deal with that is to get a good local attorney who can advise you of the pitfalls that you're going to have no idea are there until you've either stepped in them or talked to someone who has and who knows what's going on.
So you've been at this a long time, Fred. Obviously, you're an expert. So what are some of the surprises we should look out for in international transactions?
Well, I think one of the things that you really need to look for, in addition to talking to local counsel about some of the things I've just mentioned, enforcement rights are going to be really the big issue. We have the idea that we have a contract and we can march into court and have it enforced if we don't like what's going on. Not always the case in developing countries, and I'm talking about China, India, those types of places. You don't have an agreement that you can just have a court enforced. It's not going to happen. So you have to build in other mechanisms to protect your rights in terms of payments and not giving them all of the pieces of the puzzle that they need to be able to take what you have and run with it and then compete with you. Arbitration is a critical way to approach enforcement issues as well. I just got off the phone with a client that told them we need to have arbitration to resolve any disputes because that's the only way we could effectively get any remedy when there is a breach of the agreement. A judgment award here is not going to be a viable option for us.
What type of U.S. federal regulations do companies face when doing business internationally?
Let me just touch on one, because I think the biggest issue is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's illegal for a U.S. company to make a payment to a foreign official in order to obtain a favorable decision. The rest of the world, I think, or a large part of it at least, that's commonplace for them. It's illegal here in the States for a company to do that abroad. The real trick with this one is that people go to jail over it. Directors, officers can go to jail over it. And you have to make sure that you're not only complying, but that you're effectively looking for it and have safeguards in place to find those situations. You can't have your agent do it for you. As I say, you can't outsource your bribery. You're not going to get away with it. This has real teeth, and more people are getting in trouble because of failing to comply with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
All right. Well, just to wrap things up, Fred, is it even really worth doing business internationally?
You know, it is. Like anything, it's a risk-reward thing. If you do it right, you can make a lot of money and be very profitable. You do it wrong, you can lose a lot of money. You just got to go in with your eyes wide open, talk with people involved in the area. Good attorneys that are experienced in this can give you good advice and make it profitable. If you do it on your own, you either got to be lucky or have a lot of money to pay the bills.
Great way to wrap things up for us. Fred Leffler, thanks so much for joining us on this edition of U.S. Law Radio.
Great. Thanks. Glad to be here.
While we're on our international theme, let's take a look at intellectual property, issues related to trademarks, copyrights, and patents. Tom Tollison is Assistant General Counsel of the Marketing Group for U-Haul International and is a U.S. law client advisor. He's had quite a bit of direct experience in the area and joins us now to talk about it. Tom, welcome into U.S. Law Radio.
Thank you, Dan.
Well, Tom, our colleagues overseas just have a different way of doing things, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, Dan. I think what you need to be worried about overseas, especially in global markets, emerging markets, with regard to, say, your trademarks, copyrights, or even patents, first thing you need to understand if someone were to wrongfully use those or try to sell or market those intellectual properties, such as trademarks, copyrights, even patents, is to understand on a worldwide scale what types of avenues you have to stop that infringement of your intellectual property. And what I like to do, or what I like to counsel my people on here at U-Haul International Incorporated, is that we take a look, number one, at what types of organizations or what type of treaties would be involved when looking at the infringer, and specifically what country they would be located in. And specifically, you would look at, say, some Asian companies, maybe some South American companies, and find out immediately if they are members of, number one, the World Trade Organization, if they're members of the World Intellectual Property Organization, and see what treaties or what types of pacts would fall under those organizations specifically and or other treaties or pacts that the United States would have with these countries. And that's important because you need to understand the venue that you would potentially have to operate in. You'd want to see those companies in those countries that are infringing your intellectual properties, if they have membership with these organizations, understand what types of legal rights, for example, under the World Trade Organization and under the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of IP Rights, you have certain mediation and arbitration provisions that you can use to protect your intellectual property.
Can you give us an example from your experience?
With U-Haul, we had an infringer in Colombia, South America, that was infringing one of our flagship U-Haul trademarks, one of our subsidiary flagship trademarks. And it was interesting because once I started doing some research on this and dealing with the infringer and the infringer's attorney, neither of them realized that at the time they were infringing that the United States and Colombia just passed a trade promotion agreement. And in that trade promotion agreement were certain IP rights or certain IP protections and protocols in protecting IP rights. And I was able to posture that and get the other side to back down. Now, course, I had to talk a lot about litigation and lawsuits, which I'll get to, but my knowledge or the knowledge of certain trade treaties is useful in protecting IP rights.
So, of course, if you're educated, you're empowered, no doubt about it. Is it safe to say that everyone is a member of one of these organizations and that keeps us on the same page?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I would answer yes. I'd say the majority is. The majority of countries are members of these organizations, and that spans the globe. It's not just, you know, your developing Asia market or Europe. You have quite a few countries in Africa that are members of these trade agreements and organizations, and rightfully so. If you want to expand and develop infrastructure and business, the first thing that will stop a country from doing that is not protecting people's IP rights, and you're just not going to get the big companies like Coke and software manufacturers going into companies and selling these goods and sharing these, you know, IP properties, intellectual properties, and not having any type of recourse to protect them. So you see that a lot even in smaller companies across the world.
Speaking of relief, what kind of relief is out there?
Like I said, you know, understand the organization, world organizations, understand the treaties. Another thing I'd get a good grasp on is the litigation and what type of litigation relief you would have in these countries. And I'm not talking specifically through the treaties or organizations. I'm talking specifically getting up to speed with local counsel and understanding, hey, listen, I don't, you know, maybe you don't like what the remedies are of the treaty or of the organization. You don't want to go through arbitration or mediation. You want to bring a lawsuit with injunctive relief or maybe even a temporary restraining order to stop the infringing immediately where it's at. You need to get to, up to speed with local counsel on that. It's important that you deal, if you can, with law firms in the countries, in the biggest cities of the countries where the infringement is happening, so you can understand your remedies, understand the time frames, understand the pros and the cons, and also double check to see if there's any language barriers. Typically in the bigger cities, you do have attorneys that speak English, so that's not a problem. But I would say with regard to litigation and injunctive relief is understand specifically, and I think this is very critically, is if you secure a TRO, if you secure an injunction and they still violate, what does that mean? Does that mean that you have rights under the laws of that country to send in the authorities for them to collect the infringing goods, to go in there en masse and show badges and show, you know, show an official presence? Or is there just a money remedy? And I think that's important to know, because if you can't stop the infringement, then money may not be available to you in certain countries, especially if you're dealing with a moving target. So you want to understand if you have the remedy of having authorities go into, say, a manufacturing plant or into a store and actually collect the infringing goods and secure them. That's important to understand.
So I'm sure there are as many different laws and remedies as there are countries that we'd be dealing with internationally. How do you manage to stay on top of it? And what would you say to those who may be endeavoring to go international?
I think it's important to stay abreast, and it's real easy to online, to stay abreast of all the current treaties and pacts and case law that you'll find through you know, your various international bar associations. There's some good services online that keep you up to date. I also recommend, if people have access to it, to American Corporate Counsel Association's website. You don't have to be a member to see some of their good write-ups on international law. I would stay abreast of certain topics, specifically as they come on the Department of Justice website, United States Trade Representative website, and Department of Homeland Security, United States Department of Commerce. All of those have websites that talk here and there about intellectual property rights and enforcement and certain things related there too.
You are the walking yellow pages.
I try to be.
Well, Tom, we're going to wrap things up here because we're out of time. Anything you'd like to leave us with?
I would just say, also understand local enforcement. We, as United States companies, also have the ability to register our trademarks and our copyrights with the United States Customs and Border Protection Service, and that helps to stop infringing products from coming into the nation. So there's also some local enforcement remedies we have through the Customs and Border Protection Agency.
Well, Tom, we certainly do appreciate that you were able to carve out some time to help us out, and I hope you're staying cool down there in beautiful Phoenix. Thanks for joining us.
Dan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate this talk.
National Council right next door. U.S. Law Radio.
2, 3, 4.
Ooh. News from your world. This is U.S. Law Radio. Ooh. Next stop is Paris. The world is getting smaller and smaller for those of us in the legal profession these days, and the need to reach across borders and jurisdictions is growing more important. Charles Campbell is a partner at Campbell, Philippard, Legoe, Associé in Paris. Charles is here to talk about his experience with this trend and how to handle it. Charles, welcome into U.S. Law Radio.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Dan. It's a great pleasure to be on the air, as it were.
Charles, can we kick things off here first with a 30,000-foot look at your law firm and what you're up to over there?
The firm dates from 1973. Alain Philippa has been with me almost since the beginning. He's a tax lawyer. What we've been trying to do, I mean, we are a small to medium-sized firm. There are 16 lawyers by French standards, obviously by American, that's much smaller. But we try to cover a business waterfront, if you like. We do a lot of tax, a lot of labor law, which is a real minefield in France, and general commercial work.
Now tell us about your involvement with TELFA and about the organization from your perspective.
I am the current chair of TELFA, the grouping of independent law firms in Europe and a little bit beyond insofar as we have a Turkish member. And the idea behind this alliance was to federate, but not to merge, independent, like-minded law firms who felt that they required to have an international capacity to service our clients. Our clients, they're very international in Europe now as well as in the States. We need a sure pair of hands if we are sending them on to other jurisdictions. The big law firms all have their established integrated networks. We don't. We're not big enough for that. But we felt there was a real need not to just look up a directory and say there's someone we met for lunch 10 years ago in Dusseldorf. I'm sure they'll look after you. But to have people we really know and trust. And that was the genesis of the TELFA adventure.
Now, talk to us about your relationship with U.S. law.
Obviously, the United States plays a very important part in all of our practices, and we had the difficulty of each of the member firms of TELFA already had established relationships, best friends, etc., but there wasn't a unified, integrated network. And so we were very excited when we identified U.S. law, which was very recent. We've been going a bit longer than U.S. law. U.S. law has been extraordinarily successful, and now that we know them better, we understand why. And this association that we have now with U.S. law is allowing our TELFA members to have access to a very broad, both geographical and coverage by discipline, because the U.S. firms, although U.S. law firms, although primarily litigators, we discovered when we got to know them better that, in fact, they, in many circumstances, are full-service firms.
Let's talk about TELFA and some of the great work you're doing.
As I mentioned earlier, the need for TELFA within Europe arose when we identified the fact that sending a client out into the great unknown, into another jurisdiction, was not really doing either him or us a service. We wanted to send our clients to people that we knew and trusted. And you can only do that when you've known and worked with people. Over the years, we have selected, because it's a co-optation process, people don't just apply, pay the money, and join. We vet them. They're vetted by their peers. And so when someone has been selected to be a country member of TELFA, there was already a preliminary analysis done of both their technical competence, but perhaps more importantly, the fact that they were like-minded, that they had a similar set of values, and they accepted that we're now in basically a service industry. In Europe, the service industry approach is very well established, let's say in Ireland or the United Kingdom. As you go further south in Europe, we're still a bit behind that particular curve, because some of the European jurisdictions still feel that the practice of law is a rather special profession that's not quite like the others. And as you know, in the United States, it's become commoditized, and really the service aspect has become extremely important. And so at times it has been an issue to instill into the TELFA members the recognition that they have to be very service-minded, that delivery of the advice is as important or almost as important as the advice itself. The advice has to be good. We have to practice good law, and I think we do in TELFA. But we have to get up to speed and follow the U.S. example of making this, if not an overnight service, practically an overnight service. That is where you do run into differences of approach, of style.
Charles, can you talk more about some of the differences between our cultures that makes TELFA necessary?
UK lawyers have traditionally been much more hands-on involved in their clients' affairs and the negotiations of their matters than have, let's say, just taking one, the Austrians, who have perhaps an earlier 20th century approach. This is changing, but these differences do exist, and it's very important that we give appropriate briefings both to the lawyers who are going to be taking over the matter and to the clients, so they know the ambiance, the style of practice of law that they will be encountering when they go into another jurisdiction. And all of that's just about style. Of course, the second very important aspect of this is making sure that they are briefed in advance of the differences of substantive law, and they still exist, notwithstanding the common market, the European Union.
Can you give us a brief TELFA success story?
Well, I did make indirect, and I'm not going to mention the name, reference to one very satisfactory matter, which is ongoing, and that was the case of a substantial U.S. company that in the labor law field wanted to harmonize its employment practices. This is pretty much mission impossible throughout Europe because of the domestic differences. I mentioned earlier that in France in particular, we have very stringent labor laws and it's a real minefield. However, the English member of TELFA, Wedlake Bell, put together a very excellent, what we'll now call a pitch document, a proposal which was submitted to this client, and we were lucky enough to win the matter, win the instructions, as they say in the UK. Now, these instructions extended to 18 different jurisdictions. That meant that one of the point people at Wedlake Bell had to coordinate all of these different jurisdictions, take and absorb and abstract the advice that was being given so that they could produce a single package for the client, which would allow the client, insofar as it is possible, it's not entirely possible, to harmonize its procedures, its hiring and firing procedures, everything that relates to employment in these different jurisdictions. Now, that is something that, quite honestly, none of us alone could have done. We needed to have everyone pulling on the same oar. We had to have people responding in real time. The whole bid process was completed in a couple of days. And it demonstrated that together you can win and divided you certainly won't be able even to submit. None of us, I think, individually would have been approached on this kind of a matter. It was only because we were perceived as being as seamless a team as you can get that the client decided to run with the TELFA bid.
And therein lies the true value of TELFA. Well, thank you very much, Charles, for the snapshot. Do you have any parting thoughts for the U.S. law membership listening in?
I would like just to reiterate, Dan, to what an extent we are excited by several things about U.S. law. The first one is their obvious success. Several of our members have attended U.S. law meetings in the United States. I'm just back from Miami myself, and they were outstanding. They were outstanding because of the organization. Well, that you can say, yeah, well, of course it was going to be well organized. You do that better than anyone else. But there's another quality that we find sometimes lacking in Europe, and that is the enthusiasm, the can-do approach. The fact that everyone brings to the party an enormous degree of energy, which we'd like some of that to rub off. We're enthusiastic, we're optimistic, but we're old Europe. We're aware of that, and we're trying to hold ourselves up to the U.S. standards. We feel also, in a less flippant vein, that we can be of help to the U.S. members, or more exactly to their clients, and therefore to the members, and we hope that they will use the resources that we consider TELFA is for us. We certainly feel that U.S. law is an enormous resource that our TELFA members should be calling upon increasingly in the coming months and years.
Well, Charles Campbell, we're glad you could spend some time with us. Thanks for joining us here on U.S. Law Radio.
A great pleasure, Dan. Thank you very much indeed.
U.S. Law Radio.
Well, it's no secret we're trending toward globalizing our economies, and that means we're going to need legal professionals to support it. Organizations now need to help market each other to take advantage of what's going on in terms of legal exchange. John Hall is a member of the U.S. Law TELFA Integration Committee and a partner at Hall, Booth, Smith, and Slover in Atlanta. John joins us now to talk more about the effects of this globalization. John, welcome into U.S. Law Radio.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
John, there are so many opportunities abroad these days. Can you characterize for us our relationship with TELFA?
TELFA is the Trans-European Law Firm Association, which is very similar to U.S. law here in the U.S., except there are 23 firms in 23 countries, and each firm has an entire country in terms of their exclusive area. We're working with the U.S. law, started about a year ago, in forming a relationship with TELFA to have the same sort of referral, reputation, and support relationship that we have between our firms here in the U.S.
Now, this is important for us, John. Tell us why.
There's no doubt that everybody's experienced the fact that one of the key buzzwords these days is global economy. U.S. companies now more than ever are utilizing and doing business in Europe, and European companies are doing business here in the U.S. They obviously are going to need legal support and representation, both from litigation, from acquisition, from corporate work. And this is an extremely great opportunity for companies that have relationships already existing with well-established European firms who need a U.S. company, instead of looking at what may be traditional in terms of a mega firm, actually looking at firms with geographic specificity that we can offer them in U.S. law. So what we're going to have is these U.S. law firms being introduced to companies doing business in the U.S. through our TELFA partners. And then likewise, we're going to have our clients who are going to call and say, you know, do you know someone in England? Do you know someone in France? Then we'll be able to recommend to them a law firm that we have great confidence in both their skill, their quality, and the level of service that they'll provide. So TELFA, in effect, gives U.S. law the opportunity to be global. And we're really looking forward to the development of that relationship over the next few years.
What's going on currently with our relationship? Where do we stand and what's on the horizon?
We're really starting to tap into the relationship. As all of our members know, a large contingent of TELFA firms came to the U.S. law meeting in Miami. We actually are going to have TELFA firms participating with an international breakout session in Las Vegas, which is going to be great. They're going to bring international clients that will be able to meet our lawyers and hopefully foster client relationships. We recently had a group that went to the TELFA meeting. We attended the first TELFA meeting in Warsaw, Poland last year. A group went to Italy about a month ago for another TELFA meeting. And at those TELFA meetings, we're starting to put on U.S. law programs that are part of their meeting. We have a large opportunity coming up in November of this year. TELFA's meeting is going to be in Paris. We're going to hold a managing partner conference immediately before the meeting, where managing partners from TELFA firms and managing partners from U.S. firms interested in going will actually meet and talk about how to strengthen our firm-to-firm relationship and therefore strengthen the TELFA-U.S. law relationship. This is going to be an exciting time in which the firms get to know each other on a level that the exchange of business becomes easier between us. And as we go forward, U.S. law has committed to this relationship with TELFA to give it a good try and make sure that we do fit for each other. And we think these kinds of meetings and the referrals that are coming out of them establish that we are actually working well together. So we're excited about the future and think it's going to be a great horizon for both TELFA and U.S. law as we go forward.
John, you sound like you're extraordinarily impassioned about this subject, and we're thrilled to get your feedback. Any final words you want to send out to U.S. law membership before we let you get back to work?
Yeah, I do. I think the future for U.S. law is as bright as it has ever been. I'm really excited about the next year and 2 years that we're going to have with U.S. law. I think TELFA adds to that and strengthens U.S. law. And I believe the only thing that's going to stand in our way is whether or not we all continue to work as hard as we have for this organization. And I think when we do, we're going to see direct personal and financial and professional benefits to our firm. So 2008, 2009, 2010 are going to be the glory days for U.S. law.
Well, John Hall, very enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of U.S. Law Radio.
Dan, thanks for the opportunity.
Hey, that's going to do it, folks. We're out of time. U.S. Law Radio is produced by Martha Cusick-Eddy. Send your comments and show ideas Martha's way. She'd love to hear from you. This edition of U.S. Law Radio has been brought to you by SEA Limited, forensic engineering and origin cause experts working nationwide since 1970. This is Dan Walker. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and we'll see you again next time for another fresh edition of U.S. Law Radio.